We spent the first week of our trip stumbling around the holy sites of Istanbul in a jet-lagged haze that no amount of strong Turkish coffee could clear. I had arrived in Turkey as part of the Mevlana Celaluddin Rumi immersion experience with 25 other colleagues from my seminary at Star King. We admired the golden halos of icons in ancient Orthodox churches. We donned headscarves and kneeled shoulder to shoulder with Turkish women in modern liberal mosques. We climbed the cool, cramped cobblestone ramp to get to the balcony of a 4th-century church that had become a 15th-century mosque and was now a 21st-century museum. We had to show our passports and wait for clearance between bomb-proof doors at an Ashkenazi synagogue. And every day, 5 times a day, the call to prayer echoed through the city from the minarets of its 3,000 mosques. When the week ended, we watched the moon eclipse over the ferry that carried us to a train that would take us overnight to the city of Konya, the ancient homeland of Mevlana Celaluddin Rumi. So in the United States, most of us know Mevlana Celaluddin Rumi simply by the name Rumi. In the Sufi world, he is more commonly known as Mevlana, which means master or teacher. We had traveled to Konya for the annual celebration of Mevlana's life and teachings, known as the Shebi Arus. Every year, tens of thousands of Sufi Muslims from around the world descend on Konya for celebration and fellowship, prayer, and spiritual practice. The Istanbul portion of the trip was interesting, but I had really come to Turkey for this, for Konya, to join my colleagues and the Muslims from around the world in paying homage to Mevlana's life. The first book of poetry I had ever bought as a teenager was written by Rumi. And the old Unitarian Universalist joke rang very true for me. Instead of preaching the gospel of Mark or Matthew or John, UUs preach the gospel of Mary Oliver and Rumi. That's what we're doing today, anyway. I hadn't come to Turkey just to be a tourist. After a year of filling my brain with the study of theology, I had craved an experience that filled my soul. During the day, we'd study with professors and artists in residence from Mexico, India, Turkey, and the United States. We cooked meals and cleaned together. We ate together, shared tiny bedrooms, showered in cold water. And each night, we would host a worship service that was open to the entire community of Konya. In our free time, we would wander the streets. Our first day in Konya, our lead professor and Star King's resident Sufi sheikh, Dr. Ibrahim Ferajaje, gave us our opening lecture. Dr. Ferajaje told us that the human heart is like a cardamom pod. We must crack open our hearts, he said, so that love, like the rich velvety scent of cardamom, would pour forth from us and fill our senses and the world. We must crack open our hearts so that love, like the scent of cardamom, fills the world. And a few days later, one of our artists in residence, Duha, gave a workshop on voice. Duha is a Mexican singer and a spiritual leader of the Sufi community in her hometown. Duha told us that our voices were entwined with our truth, and that voicing the song of our soul frees us. And then she sang a song that she had written, gathered together from the words of the 25 of us on that pilgrimage. She didn't sing words that I had written. She didn't even sing words entirely in a language that I understood. But as Duha arrived at the refrain, I felt that she was singing directly to me. I cannot rise until I say yes.
Et ben deirahi ashk. Evet ben de irahi ashk.
I leaned back against the lush cobalt and gold carpet that draped the wall. I cannot rise until I say yes. Evet ben de irahi ashk. In Turkish, evet means yes, and ben de irahi ashk can be roughly translated to I am a servant on the path of love. It's a refrain spoken often by those on the Sufi path. I cannot rise until I say yes, yes, I am a servant on the path of love. I cannot rise until I say yes. For a long time, I had been struggling with saying yes. The previous 5 years had been difficult ones for me. My father had been diagnosed with and later died from brain cancer. 2 years later, my marriage collapsed. And shouldering my grief, I tried to begin life anew on the other side of the country, only to feel the call to ministry shortly thereafter. Theologian Friedrich Buchner says that we are each called to the place where our deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. And we each have our own unique purposes. We each have something that we want to contribute to and receive from life. And whether we figured out that specific purpose or not, I bet that for most of us in this room, our purpose somehow has to do with love. For me, the call to ministry is the call to be a servant on the path of love. This work ignites my passion and unites my heart and mind and body and soul. It invites me to be a force for love and justice in the world. I had spent years in a professional rut as I had searched for a vocation that called me so completely. And I had finally found it. But following my call meant beginning life anew, again, as I moved to yet another city to start seminary. And I'll be honest, I really resented my call. Why should the choice to become a servant on the path of love force me to leave behind so many loving relationships? I was angry. The call. It's love. Answer. We planned that. No. At the time, I was angry, and I was grieving, and I was lonely. We've all experienced loss, right? Each one of us has found ourselves in a rut at some point in our lives that we can't seem to climb out of. Perhaps you've thrown yourself into work or a relationship, only to find that the job or the new love that you were so excited about became stale. Perhaps you've done what you believed you should do, only to find that your reward is not the fulfillment you expected. Maybe instead the result is an aching sense of emptiness, or worse, a frantic feeling of being trapped. Perhaps an injury or just plain time has taken away physical or mental abilities that you used to take for granted. Or perhaps someone you thought that you couldn't live without died. And you're still here. When we lose something or someone that matters to us, our whole being grinds to a halt. Our limbs may feel too heavy to lift, and so our bodies remain limp and still. Words become disconnected from their meanings, and so we remain silent. We become immobilized when our hearts empty of feeling, overflow with grief, or boil with rage. Though rest and caring are needed to survive this kind of loss, we need more than just comfort to be able to return to life. I cannot rise until I say yes. By the time I had arrived in Turkey, I was already a year into seminary, but I was not fully on board. Life had asked me if I would immerse myself in ministry, and my answer had been a tentative and begrudging, I suppose. I knew ministry was the right path, and yet I was shuffling down that path, eyes downcast and occasionally looking back over my shoulder. I cannot rise until I say yes. Something in me knew that I would never really thrive unless I let go of the chains of resentment and said yes with all my heart and soul. Duha's song had asked me for more than I suppose. She had asked me for a yes. So I began to sing to myself as I walked around Konya. In shops stacked high with prayer rugs, I cannot rise until I say yes. Thanking the street vendor for the fresh pomegranate juice and the warm sesame-scented pretzel. Eved benehirahiyashk. Covering my face from the thick fog of coal smoke that blanketed the city every night. Eved benehirahiyashk. As the twists and turns of Konya's vibrant streets began to be inscribed on my memory, the call to say yes began to be inscribed on my heart. Now, 6 months after my visit to Konya found me in a very different environment. I was serving as a chaplain in the psychiatry ward of a Maryland hospital. And the hospital staff members were kind, but the psychiatry unit was still a grim place to be. Instead of visiting patients in their rooms like you did in other parts of the hospital, chaplains always met with the psychiatry patients in what we called the day room. The day room was stark. It had white walls and tiled floors. Half of the room held a series of sterile round tables and gray plastic chairs, and the other half held a couple of aqua blue pleather chairs that were torn and stained. In one corner of the room sat a pile of battered and torn board games. On the other side sat a small bookshelf, empty except for the occasional book on mental illness or Bible. There was a view, but there was no way to get outside. The TV played an endless series of Law and Order episodes. There were no plants on the unit. There was no music, no privacy, no art. One day I received a referral to visit a man that I'll call James. James had come to the hospital after finding himself about to walk out into the street in front of a bus. James was a quiet, unassuming man with a gentle manner. Every day he wore a pair of hospital-issue navy sweatpants and a white t-shirt. And the first few times I visited with him, I don't think he smiled even once. You wouldn't know it if you met him, but James told me that he had been an alcoholic and an addict since he was 14 years old. Though he had spent long stretches of his life sober, he always somehow, for some reason, seemed to relapse. He told me about how much he loved his children and his girlfriend and his girlfriend's children. But when he had relapsed this time, his girlfriend told him that she had had enough. He had just found out that his ex-wife had taken his two children back to the Dominican Republic with her. James didn't think he'd see any of them ever again. He had dropped out of school, and no one in his family would take him in. And for the first time in his life, he found himself on the street. Talking with James felt like calling down a deep well to somebody who didn't want to be rescued. For James, there was no reason to keep on living. There was no hope. He had nothing to give to the world, and the world had already taken everything from him. But he told me that he missed having God in his life. He had been trying to reconnect with God by reading the Bible, but he said that it wasn't working. And I'm a Unitarian Universalist, so I said, well, reading the Bible isn't the only way to connect with God. Why not start with what you know? Where have you felt God's presence before? James told me that he used to feel God's presence in a song. When he was getting divorced, he said he listened to the song on repeat just dozens of times a day, just to get by. If I can find that song on YouTube, do you want to listen to it with me? And I'd expected to hear a song of compassion, or maybe a song that promised that one day things would be good again. At best, I thought maybe a good breakup song. So I handed James one of my earphones, and we each put one in our ears, and I pressed play.
Will your heart and soul say yes? Will your spirit still say yes? There is more that I require of.
I had been wrong. It wasn't a song of pity. It wasn't a song of despair or even a song of promise. It was a song that asked something of James. It called him to say yes to life. It told him that life requires more of him, more than he had yet given, and it asked him to commit wholeheartedly to life again. When the song ended, we both removed the earphones from our ears and sat in silence for a minute. Finally, James said, "Thanks. I really needed to hear that." "Me too," I said. Back in Konya, I had been singing to myself for days by the time the Shebi-Arus ceremony finally came. Thousands flocked to the large museum in the center of town that houses Mevlana Rumi's tomb to await the ceremony. My group had arrived over an hour early, and shortly I found myself standing directly in front of Mevlana's tomb. I had become separated from everyone but one other person in my group, and he was about 10 feet away. The air was filled with a buzz of conversation that I couldn't understand. The man to my left prayed with a small copy of the Quran held close to his face. The woman in front of me chanted quietly as she passed prayer beads one after another through her fingers. And as more and more people filled the hall, it became more and more difficult to move. We were standing so close that if just one person had become violent, we would become a human stampede. I was separated from my group. I didn't speak or understand the language of the people around me. I was one wave in an ocean of people, and yet I was alone, cramped and unable to move, waiting. I felt all of the loneliness and the resentment and grief of the past 5 years well up inside me. And so I prayed. God, universe, everything, emptiness, music, love. I cannot rise until I say yes. Evet bendeyi rahi ashk. Yes, I am a servant on the path of love. I want my heart to be broken open. I'm ready to say yes. Help me to say yes. I cannot rise until I say yes. Yes. I cannot rise until I say yes. Yes. Yes, I am a servant on the path of love. Help me to serve love. Help me to say yes. Yes. Tears began to roll down my face as my heart began to relax. I kept praying and kept crying, and suddenly, unexpectedly, the soft, spicy scent of cardamom wafted past my nose. I laughed out loud as the tears continued to trail down my face. Dr. Ferjage wasn't kidding. Love really does smell like cardamom. My friend looked over to me from where he stood. Seeing my tears, he mouthed, "Are you okay?" "Yes." My friends, when we feel stagnant or empty or devastated by loss, comfort will help us subsist for a time. Being cared for by others and being gentle with ourselves is the first step to survival and healing. But for us to return to life from our malaise or hopelessness, we must listen to what our life is asking of us, and we must say yes to it. Just as long as we have breath, may we answer yes to life. Life requires more from us. Love requires more from us. We must all say yes. We cannot rise until we say yes. Yes, we are servants on the path of love. Yes, may we all be servants on the path of love. May the song of our souls sing yes. Amen.